Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspectives.
All righty, Madigan. Well, it is the first day of Black History Month.
It is indeed. Happy Black History Month, Keegan.
Thank you so much. The best yet shortest month of the year.
So misrepresented. It's really, I mean, obviously, but it's horrible.
Why? Is there a reason
that February, is there a reason that they chose February to be Black History Month?
Yeah. Do you know that? I mean,
in my head, I feel like it was some white asshole that's like, it's the shortest month, we'll just give it.
That's canon in my own brain, but yeah, I'm not like, sure I don't know if that's actually the reason. Like, I'm sure that there is some kind of bogus reason, but for me, I'm just like, listen, I'm not speaking for all Black people as though we're a monolith, but in general, the cold is not our jam, okay? And February is typically a bad weather month, and it's the shortest month of the year. So doesn't really make a lot of sense to me that this should be the month of our people. However, it is. So,
I mean, I will still celebrate it for 31 days. I'll celebrate it into March 2nd. That's totally fine with me.
Well, we always do four episodes anyway, so it never gets ripped off in our book. But then they present us with an interesting challenge because they do Black History Month right before Women's History Month.
Yes, exactly. Because then it kind of cuts into Women's History. It's true.
Mm-hmm.
What the heck?
So we just bleed into April is what we have to do.
Yeah, I do love, though, that this kind of starts the time for us in the podcast that we have, like, not really things planned, but we have, like, these months ahead where we have, like, a general, like, we have our general topics already kind of, like, set up for us. We have Black History Month, then we have Women's History Month, and then after that would be Coming Out Month in June. Or no, we usually do, we haven't done this in a while, but like a motherhood episode in May would be great.
That's right.
And then we have Coming Out Month in June. So this kind of starts our like holiday celebrations almost, it feels like, with the themes of our episodes. You know?
And that's usually helpful for us so that we're not like scrambling 3 days before we record. That's an exaggeration. It's usually not 3 days.
I mean, I feel like it's definitely happened before where we've been like, fuck, we have to figure something out immediately. But yes, typically it's a little bit longer than that, but it is helpful when you at least have like a general topic to then pick and choose from. And I feel like we also think of things throughout the year that we write in the list.
We do.
It's just the easiest time for us, you know? It's great. So we are going to start out Black History Month with something that I knew nothing about until like probably a couple years ago. I'd heard a little bit about it. I'd heard it mentioned again recently in another documentary, I think, that I was watching. I couldn't remember who put it on the list. Was it you or me?
I feel like it was you who put this on the list.
Because I think I heard it in something else and I was like, oh, I don't really know anything about that. And so I put it down. And much like a lot of the topics that we discuss during Black History Month or whenever we're talking about something that happened a long, long time ago, I don't know if you had this experience this week, but it was really hard to find things that felt like a full story, something fully factual and something fully from the perspective of the enslaved people within the rebellion.
Oh, that was nearly impossible. So mine is not entirely from that perspective. It has other things added in. But it's also important to recognize that that was largely by design. You know, it was definitely revisionist history for the most part told through the lens of the quote unquote victors of the situation. You know, they went into damage control mode about this.
Yes, they
pretty
did.
Pretty much right away.
Yeah. And it's really interesting how this story has been passed down because it was seen as, you know, after this rebellion, which we're obviously going to get into the entire thing, but after it happened, they made it seem like there was no possible way that this revolt could have possibly been successful. They made it seem like it was just this silly thing. Mm-hmm. There was no way in hell that the enslaved rebels would actually win, when in reality, they had a lot of manpower. A lot of these people had history in fighting in other rebellions mm-hmm. and in wars. They had weapons. They had stolen militia uniforms. Like, they were legit and very, very smart and well organized. So that was
very close to pulling it off, really. I mean,
so close to pulling it off. Like, That's why they had to change the story, because there's no way they could tell it as being like, well, we almost got beat, you know?
Right, right. I mean, if one thing, which we will discuss as we move through this story, if one uh-huh. thing had been different, then I think that they would have had a very good chance of making it to New Orleans. And who knows what would have happened if that would have happened.
I know.
We didn't even say what we're talking about today, but it is in our title. We are going to be talking about the 1811 German Coast Uprising. And I really didn't know very much about this either, which is kind of surprising to me. Although in learning a little bit more about the revisionist history that took place and the, you know, kind of like wiping away of all of this,
right.
It's not as surprising. There were people living in Louisiana who didn't know about this, but my family is from Louisiana. My black family, I've traced, you know, my genealogical roots. I had black family living in Louisiana in the 1800s.
Oh,
in
my
this,
gosh.
In this area.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, and it's probably because it wasn't written to be a success. So why would we learn about it? You know what I mean? I think that's why, like, it's just kind of starting to come out now. But I was really interested about learning the history of how the sugar boom even came mm-hmm. to the United States, and how some of these enslaved people that would start the rebellion came to the United States and got all of these ideas. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the sugar boom to start with. So in Louisiana's German coast, what was known as the sugar boom began after the Revolutionary War. In 1780, a formerly enslaved man by the name of Jean St. Malo established a colony for black people in the swamps of New Orleans. So he kind of created this little community of just the black people in the area. Spain was still in control of this part of Louisiana at the time, so when they heard of this discovery, the Spanish officials sent a militia who captured Jean St. Malo, who was executed. After his execution, Malo became a folk hero in New Orleans. A decade later, during the height of the French Revolution, Spanish officials uncovered another conspiracy hatched by the enslaved at Point Coup. It was planned to occur on Easter weekend, but was shut down before it began. 23 enslaved were executed by hanging, and then their heads were decapitated and displayed on the roads of New Orleans. And the reason I'm saying this is because this will all be seen. This is all kind of things that prelude to the 1811 uprising and some
right.
of the things that may have inspired and been replicated during
that
time.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also an important thing to bring up. And we're going to, you know, also talk about the Haitian Revolution a little bit. But I do think it's important to bring these things up because as part of the, you know, kind of wiping away of this event, they really want you to believe that it was kind of this spontaneous ragtag group of people
yeah.
and not people who had been planning revolutions and rebellions for a very long time. I mean, and
yes.
there are even ones that we probably won't talk about here, but especially throughout that region, because it was so ethnically diverse, throughout that region, there had been small uprisings happening for a while. So the
right.
whispers between the plantations, whenever these people would gather, as they would oftentimes on Sundays whenever they were permitted to be off of work, a lot of these enslaved people would gather and share stories and information. So when there were these kind of small little bitty uprisings or rebellions happening that were usually squashed pretty quickly, it emboldened people to want to do something more.
Right. So these actually occurred in other parts of the world as well. So some of these were happening in France, and then there was the Haitian Revolution, which occurred between 1790 and 1804, which is a really fucking long time.
Mm-hmm.
That is a 14-year rebellion, and that actually led to Haiti gaining independence, I guess you would say. I wrote independence, but I don't know if that's really the word.
It was basically, and I don't believe it was all of Haiti. I did skim an article about this, but I don't believe it was all of Haiti. But there was a region of Haiti that in which the enslaved people did revolt against their captors and eventually established an independent black state. So okay, it yes. wasn't the entire country,
but it was there that was area.
Yes, they basically said, like, we have claimed this area as an independent black state. And so, right. I mean, and really, another thing to highlight is that at that point in Haiti, the black people outnumbered the black enslaved people outnumbered the white people in Haiti like 5-1. So yeah. they had numbers on their side, which is kind of the same thing that we start to see in the Louisiana area as Definitely. Well. And after this, people who were not part of that successful revolt, but people in the surrounding areas near that area in Haiti were sold into slavery in Louisiana. So the story.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because a lot of these other countries and areas were no longer producing sugarcane and they no longer had the slave labor. Also, the ports to the U.S. colonies in the Americas were opened up as well to be sending more enslaved people from Africa, from Haiti, from all over, you know, parts of the world. So Louisiana kind of took on sugarcane. They were really into cotton and indigo before, but then when there was kind of a lull in the sugarcane market, they were like, we're going to take that on. And we're also going to take all of your enslaved people as well. So by 1802, in Louisiana and in this German coast, 70 sugar plantations produced over 3,000 tons of sugar every year. It was insane.
And it should be said that, especially in Haiti, kind of what spurred on the birth of that rebellion in Haiti was because whenever, in order to acquire that much sugarcane, they were working the enslaved people in an incredibly inhumane way. I mean, nothing right. about slavery, of course, is humane, but it was so bad that the mortality rate for enslaved people in Haiti was significantly higher. The lifespan of an enslaved person in Haiti was significantly shorter because they wanted to get such a large quantity production yes. of sugar.
And they were inspired by that in Louisiana as well. So they didn't just take on the sugarcane. They took over a lot of the really brutal working conditions that were being done in other countries to get that kind of success as well. So just like you said, you know, these longer hours and more brutal punishments mm-hmm. were incredibly damaging to these people. And they didn't, obviously, it was more so about having, you know, the youngest, the healthiest, the strongest. So it really didn't matter if these lives were being cut short. It only mattered that they were getting the
yeah,
product
of course.
That
and again, there were so many. I mean, they were bringing over people in the transatlantic slave trade at such a rate that, I mean, it was very much, they were fairly disposable. I do want to say before we move on, the German coast is a, for because I didn't know, and again, my family uh-huh. is from the area, the German coast is a fertile agricultural region that's upriver from New Orleans. So it's about 60 miles outside of New Orleans proper up the river. So about away from like about 60 miles from the French Quarter, essentially.
Okay. Well, yeah. I want to talk a little bit about Governor William C.C. Claiborne, because he is a big player in this as well. So after the U.S. negotiated the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, both Marquis de Lafayette and James Monroe, Hamilton, hello, declined the role of territorial governor. So Thomas Jefferson turned to fellow Virginian William C.C. Claiborne. And Claiborne really struggled as governor of it must have been of all of Louisiana there. I don't know why. New Orleans, governor of
Louisiana, the Louisiana Territory. So this was before Louisiana was actually a state.
A state, yeah.
So Claiborne, also another reason why they wanted him there was because he was really pushing for statehood. So yeah. It was a large goal. It was a big goal of his, you know.
Yeah, and he struggled a lot because there was such a vast, diverse population in Louisiana. They had a very large Native American population, French, Spanish, Haitian, and he didn't speak French or Spanish. So he struggled a lot in that area. And he also wasn't used to the number of free people of color that Louisiana had, and he didn't really know how, his brain didn't comprehend the fact that there could be freed people of color in the area, and he wasn't a big fan of that. In the overall territory of Orleans from 1801 to 1811, the free black population nearly tripled to 5,000, so he was very overwhelmed. French Creole residents who had lived there for a long time were really pissed about how Claiborne was handling the territory and treating its citizens, so they complained to Washington, D.C. about numerous items of contention. By 1805, a delegation led by Jean-Noël d'Estrehan went to Washington to complain about the oppressive and degrading form of territorial government. President Madison, of course, denied their requests and sided with Claiborne. With the spread of the idea of freedom from the French and the Haitian revolutions, European Americans began to worry about the enslaved uprisings as well. So,
yeah, so let's set it up a little bit. So you have kind of the understanding of what the political tensions and things were like in the Louisiana area at that time. So let's go into a little bit more about specifics. So Charles Deland was born around 1789 on the plantation of Jacques Deland. And
well, he was born in Haiti, which I think is really important to mention.
Accounts differ on that because there's no actual record of him having been born in Haiti. Like, we don't know necessarily if he was born in Haiti because they didn't keep Jacques Deland, didn't keep good records. However,
because I thought it was really interesting because then I went into like math mode and I was like, well, then he was born just 2 years before the Haitian Revolution began. So he was like brought up within that culture of like rebellion and revolution in Haiti.
See, I kind of think even if he was born in Haiti, it seems to me as though he was taken to the plantation of Jacques Deland fairly young, is what it would seem like to me. So I'm not sure if he was actually brought up in Haiti or born in Haiti. People kind of make those connections because he did basically preach the gospel of the Haitian Revolution to other enslaved people.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say that I read in some articles that he lived in Haiti for quite a while and was like he was young, like not an older man or like a full-grown man or anything, but I want to say maybe like 11 or 12-ish. Some people are saying that he maybe came over. Are you fact-checking?
Yes. Okay. So here is what I found, and this is just from Wikipedia. It says, contrary to many published articles, we do not know if Jacques Deland ever brought Charles over from Saint-Dominique after the revolt there. There is no record of Jacques ever having lived in Saint-Dominique. There is no record of Jacques buying Charles before he died in 1793, and he has a continual documented presence in Louisiana from the time he was 17. So
yeah, see, because that's kind of where I got it, because I think maybe that when you just mentioned 17, maybe that's kind of where other historians have written, like when he was like a teenager or something was when he came over, because I found that really interesting. If he, in a world where, let's say, he did live in Haiti during that time, like I found that really interesting, but clearly,
I'm not sure where it came from, because it doesn't look as though Jacques or Charles, there's any documented evidence that they probably lived there.
It's probably just, it probably fit in with the story really well. Like, it kind of sounds like maybe that was added folklore to him, where maybe that was just like a story that was perpetuated about him being in Haiti during that time to kind of add to the legend of what he did in the German coast, you know?
That's kind of where my mind went. And we don't exactly know, because again, slave records are so hard to track down,
right?
That it gets very difficult. But what we do know was that he was born on the plantation of Jacques Deland, wherever that was at the time of his birth. We're not sure. And he was described as a quote Creole mulatto slave, and he was sold to Manuel Andre. Or Andre, when he was about 17 years old. So the other thing about Charles Deland is that his father was white and his mother was black. I tend to assume
his father raped his mother and he is a product of rape. Yeah, that's
I assume that Jacques Deland is his father, but we don't know that because, of course, there's no official record, but that is what I would tend to assume.
I mean, to me, that part was written in bold pink letters obvious, but well, you know, but this is speculation. It could have been someone else, but
know,
I mean,
we don't know for sure,
but we know that that was a very common practice at the time. So when you hear that there was, you know, that he had a white father and an enslaved mother, you can kind of only assume that it was possibly DeLong himself, or at least maybe someone that worked for DeLong. And we know it was not a loving conception and relationship that he was brought out of, which always makes me feel sad. That's psychological damage that I think people don't understand that you can experience before you're even born. It's just hard.
I think Charles DeLong probably had a lot of psychological damage because he was sold to Manuel Andry when he was 17. And because of his light complexion from being biracial, he did have preferential treatment within the Andry home, which he quickly rose to become Andry's right-hand man and overseer. So he was dealing out punishment to other enslaved people on the plantation, and he was hated by the other enslaved people on the plantation because he was so brutal an overseer. However, he was so brutal an overseer because he was trying to maintain this facade and maintain this trust from the, you know, white ruling slave owning class, and Andry in particular. So
definitely.
He definitely started to hate the slave owning class in his 17 years on the DeLong plantation. And again, it's unclear as to where he picked up the tale of the Haitian Revolution, whether it was something that he had experienced in his own life or if it was something that was picked up because there were so many Haitian enslaved people who had been sold into that area who told the tale of what they had experienced.
I remember reading somewhere in my research as well that there were, like, you know, some would have copies of, you know, the story of the rebellion and things like that. So I think that, you know, especially in this area, having enslaved people from so many different parts of the world who have experienced so many different things too, it makes sense that, you know, those stories would be passed on.
So in the autumn of 1810, DeLong met up with two other men, Cook and Kamana, and they were both recent arrivals from West Africa. And both of these men likely had military experience from their time in West Africa before they were brought over. So Charles DeLong told the men about the Haitian Revolution and how the people of Haiti had slaughtered their captors and established an independent black state. Uh-huh. And so that's when these three men are the three who were kind of the catalyst for what would become the German Coast Uprising. So they started planning this revolt. And many enslaved people in the region during this time were permitted to gather on Sundays in what was called the Congo Square. So actually, I mean, they weren't permitted to gather per se, but they were given the day off usually on Sunday. And it naturally became a thing that they started doing. And it also really speaks to how much the slave owning class in this time period, the white people basically in this area, took these people. They thought that these people were so below them that they weren't capable.
Yeah, that they underestimated them.
They underestimated them entirely. Like, because these people outnumber you. You're treating them like garbage. And then you don't think that they're enough of a threat. It wasn't until after this revolt that they started limiting the ways in which, you know, fellow slaves could gather together in large numbers.
Definitely.
Partially because that's how it got the word spread from plantation to plantation that, like, hey, this is a thing that's going to go down.
Right.
That's
how every rebellion started. You know, they're stupid. The thing is it's like they have taken away their ability for education and for, you know, giving them the opportunity to have the chance to revolt and uprise. So in their minds, it's probably like, what are they gonna, like, we're not giving them any of the tools to be able to do that. So how would it even happen? You know, wasn't even a worry for them.
I don't think it was. They literally, which is so stupid, especially given what had just happened in Haiti, for them to think like this could never happen here. You know, and as we said, of course, there were some people who were concerned about that in Louisiana, especially, or in New Orleans, especially. But a lot of these people who lived in these rural communities and these plantations really, even after the uprising began, which we'll discuss, weren't even as concerned as they should have been.
No.
Because they underestimated these people because they saw them as less than human.
Right? Yes,
so they were like,
exactly.
They don't have the capability to go against us. You know, they're not smart enough. They're not strong enough.
Exactly.
To plan something like
and
this.
And some of the enslaved people who had heard about the uprising even went to their slavers and were like, hey, this is going to happen. You know,
right.
Like a lot of these slavers were warned ahead of time. And some of them did flee and, you know, protect themselves. And some of them
didn't.
Like Andre, I think. Or no, it wasn't Andre. It was another one that I've written where he had heard about the rebellion happening. And he was just like, no, I'm going to stay put. So it really was just kind of like it depended on the person and whether or not they bought that this was actually going to happen and that it would be a threat, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. Okay. So festivities were in full swing prior to Carnival in early January 19.
Which was kind of like they were kind of celebrating Mardi Gras, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's basically Mardi Gras. So it was early January 1811. And this kept a lot of the white people in the area distracted. And it also allowed a lot of the enslaved people extra time to gather. And it was also around this time that the governor of Louisiana, William Claiborne, had sent most of the military troops at his disposal to Baton Rouge to secure the military annexation of Spain from Florida. So this
so
left New Orleans defenseless, basically.
Yes,
and
definitely.
That, I mean, it was, again, they're trying to make you believe that these enslaved people were stupid, when in reality, like, they had planned this entire thing. They knew what was going on. They knew that the military presence in New Orleans was going to be almost nothing.
Yeah.
And they planned their rebellion around that. It was all by design.
Beautiful.
So the timing was perfection.
Mwah. Perfect timing, definitely. Well, it was on the night of January 8th, 1811, when the rebellion began. So let's see. The uprising began on the plantation owned by Manuel Andre on the east side of Mississippi, and that was the plantation that Charles Delon was living on.
Mm-hmm. It was the Woodland plantation. And so on that night, Delon and 25 other enslaved people armed with axes and knives used to harvest sugarcane broke into the house. And they went to Manuel Andre first.
Yes.
But he woke up, saw Charles Delon standing over him. I do not know. Of course, there's not a lot of information. Like, I don't know how he got out of this situation alive, but somehow
this man
managed to escape.
Yeah, I think that I wonder if they thought that he had been injured enough that he wasn't going to make it. That was kind of, I kind of figured that maybe they thought that he had been beaten enough that he would die of his injuries.
Well,
I don't know if they anticipated the fact that he was going to live.
Regardless of what they thought, this was the biggest mistake that they made during this revolt. They should have
finished him off.
That he was dead, because this is what caused their downfall ultimately, unfortunately.
Well, and they made Andre even more motivated and angry because they killed his son Gilbert. So this gives Andre even more, you know, intent to want to bring this down, obviously.
Yes. And so Manuel Andre is very wounded. Like, I don't know. They stabbed him. He was pretty wounded.
Yeah.
But he manages to make it to the river. He gets in a canoe and he paddles to the west bank of Mississippi. And once he's there, he bursts into the home of a plantation owner named James Perret, and he tells him what's going down.
Yes, like, exactly.
Prepare yourselves, which gives, you know, a lot of these plantation owners notice, right?
Yes.
That they wouldn't have had before. They lose a little bit of that element of surprise that was on their side.
Yeah, and this was their first stop as well. So while they're continuing this rebellion, there is already another plan going to try to bring it down. So while Andre is bloodily trying to make his way to the other plantation, Charles Delon and his and his fellow rebels go and take pieces of Andrei's militia uniform. And this, like I said earlier, was something that happened in multiple rebellions before. Mm-hmm. And this is a way to, you know, legitimize this war, this battle that was happening. So it wasn't that they were just wearing their everyday clothes and their, you know, the right. clothes given by their slavers. Mm-hmm. They were actually wearing very official military uniforms.
Right.
And mm-hmm. there were also people that said that, you know, they were marching with drums and, you know, they had a very official kind of air about them because they stole shit. Love it.
Right. They very much wanted to, they did not want to appear as like brigands, right? They wanted to appear as a unified, they wanted people to know we are a unified front. This was something that we planned. We're revolutionaries. And they did take this page directly out of, you know, the Haitian Revolution.
Yeah.
Because that's what they did. And there were drawings of that that I'm sure circulated, those stories circulated. And while they were in the Andrei home, you know, they not only got the militia uniforms, they also found guns. Uh-huh. And this is something that they would do as they went, you know, as they went along to different plantation homes, you know. Yeah. They would start taking weapons and stuff like that. So no longer was it just axes and knives, now they are armed with actual guns.
Exactly. And not only are they collecting more and more weapons and, you know, military uniforms along the way, they're also collecting more and more people who are joining the rebellion, to the point where Wikipedia said that anywhere between 10 to 25% of any given plantation's enslaved population joined in on the revolution, which is a lot. So right. as they're moving down, up or down the coast first? I think they were moving.
I think it was down actually, the coast. So, but along the river, headed towards New Orleans.
Okay.
So, but I think it is south, but I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. So let's just say as they're moving down. Sure. They're or collecting along, yeah. or as they're moving along. That's a great way of putting it.
we don't know.
They are, you know, they're banding together more and more people, more and more weaponry, more and more strength as well. But like we said, as this is going on, Andrei is also warning other people and they are also beginning to set up their own militia as well.
Right. So, you know, like you said, there was a large number of the enslaved population who joined in. They estimate that by the end of the day, it was about 1/4 total of the enslaved population of the German coast had joined them. So they were about 500 strong within a day. And so yeah. you can kind of just picture it. It's all of these, you know, newly emboldened enslaved people. They've got drums. They've got guns. They've got torches.
They've got this mob mentality going.
And as they should, and yeah. they're headed to New Orleans and they're screaming freedom or death yep. along the way. And they are, you know, burning down plantations as they go. Mm-hmm. So like you said, word of the uprising had now spread and there were a lot of white slave owners who were fleeing their homes and making for the city. But there was one, and I wanted to tell this story and it might be the same one you have. There was one particularly cruel planter named Trepanier.
Mm-hmm.
And he was said to have an enslaved boy named Gustav that he kept as a, quote, pet on a leash. He would keep him on a leash on his front porch, throwing him food scraps and treating him like a dog, essentially. Cruel. I say all of that so that you have an idea of what kind of person this was.
Yeah.
And he was warned by yeah. a faithful, loyal person in his household that this was happening and that he should flee to the city, and he refused to leave his home. He basically yeah. scoffed at this idea, and so he sat on his porch and waited, and when he saw the mob arriving, he began to shoot at them, but they were too far away for him to do any damage. So Cook, which was that West African man that we mentioned earlier,
yeah.
he managed to sneak up the back door of Trepanier's house, creep up behind him, and bury an axe in his skull. So
he fucking did. Yep.
Took him out. And we can only assume that other, you know, slave owners who offered a lot of resistance or refused to flee or attempted to fight the rebels probably received a similar fate.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, if you're not running and you're there, I mean, that's their objective right now, is to get rid of you. So yeah, I'm sure that wasn't an isolated incident where this happened, but I'm very glad that we have that story because I think that it displays, you know, the arrogance of these and narcissism, you know, just these cruel, cruel people, you know, trying to stand their ground and not realizing the power and the strength behind the people that they've been mistreating for so long. Even though I doubt that these rebels knew maybe this particular story or what was happening to this boy in particular, mm-hmm. it is satisfying to hear that full story, to know that there was a lot of, I don't want to say good, because people were killed, so it sounds weird to say that, but there was good that came out of this.
Well, the thing is, yes, of course, I mean, this always, when you're talking about things like this and you're talking about people dying oftentimes in a cruel manner, I mean, getting an axe to the skull is a bad way to go, I'd say.
Not my way that I would want, you know.
However, I mean, there is a maybe somewhat sick satisfaction in hearing stories like this, because you can't treat an entire group of people as subhuman. All they want is equality, and all they want are their rights. And had you not been treating them as animals, disposable, then we wouldn't be in this situation. Like,
yeah, don't it's put karma.
People, right. You don't put people in a situation to have to kill you for their independence.
Definitely.
And then be surprised when it happens. And again, like, yeah, the pure arrogance and hubris in sitting on your front porch when an army of 500 armed people is coming your way, to think that you're going to be able to fight them off, or you have any kind of authority,
right,
in
that you're
situation.
Somehow impervious to any sort of injury or harm. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. They also went to the Mulian plantation, which was the largest and wealthiest plantation in the German coast. And there they also picked up a lot of people to join the rebellion as well. And they destroyed the Mulian plantation, which is great.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So, word had spread to New Orleans at this point, and the white people were panicking. They're freaking out.
They were clutching their pearls. They were tearing them off. Their hair was
terrified.
On fire.
And, you know, Governor Claiborne, this will sound familiar from last summer, Governor Claiborne issued a 6 p.m. curfew for black men in the city, mm-hmm. and then ordered that all bars in the city be closed. He's like, board them up.
Board up the bars.
Because most of the army was preoccupied, you know, with the situation in Florida, Claiborne could only scrape together a militia of about 100 volunteers to go up against this army of enslaved people, which was five times as many in number. So it's like 100 militiamen against 500 of the other. So the 100
exactly.
volunteers marched up to meet the revolt. And along the way, they picked up stragglers of fleeing slave owners or planters who agreed to join them.
Yeah, I had written down that by nightfall, General Wade Hampton and Governor Claiborne sent two groups of volunteer militia, 30 regular troops, and a detachment of 40 seamen to fight the rebels. I don't know what they mean by regular troops, especially because those troops were in Florida. So I don't know if maybe some of those were making their way back to that wouldn't make any sense. It would take too long, so I don't know.
Well, it's possible that not every troop, you know, not every soldier went to Florida. Like, they could have kept a small number behind to help protect the city. They just didn't think they were going to need that many.
Right,
so maybe
right.
they only kept a handful, you know, because I'm assuming also Governor Claiborne probably had people there protecting him.
Yeah. So, I mean, definitely nothing in comparison to the rebels that were coming their way, but there was still, they were able to round up, you know, quite a few people in a short amount of time, particularly being that their military was not in the state. So.
Right. Yeah. So DeLong, along with the others, had decided to stop for the night at the Kenner and Henderson plantation, which, fun fact, is where the New Orleans airport stands today.
Oh, funny.
And while they were there, the militia was coming, you know, from the other side, and they were like, okay, we're going to ambush them in the night while they're at this plantation. When they attacked, however, they found that the camp had been almost completely abandoned. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Europeans at the time looked at this decision by DeLon to fall back and not engage as a cowardly act that he was, like, running.
Yeah.
However, this was actually a calculated West African tactic that had been used very often in wars, which is, to me, a no-brainer. I mean, I feel like the European way of fighting, you know, like the way we fought the
to
Revolutionary War.
To slowly move forward toward each other.
To slowly advance.
Yeah.
and all of that is such a European way of looking at like civil war.
It makes no sense to me. Whenever I watch old war movies, I'm just like, how does this work? Like, you're just it's chaos. Because
they have this mentality that like war can be civil, like there's civility. Yeah.
We have war. We have rules and like a like a acknowledgement. Agreement. Yes, exactly. Like an acknowledgement of each other that like we don't do certain things.
But that is, first of all, war is not civil.
No, like, all is fair in love and war, baby.
And it just makes sense. So this West African tactic, which was likely suggested by Cook and Kamana, who had, you know, again, fought wars, they were like, why fight a battle that you're unprepared for when you can retreat, lure the enemy into a battle on your own terms, yeah, on higher ground? And so that's what they were planning to do. So they start moving back the other direction. The militia is following them the other direction. And it's not looking good for the militiamen at this point. They're vastly outnumbered and the rebels are seeking higher ground. So they're like, we're going to strike you on our terms.
Yep.
However, I told you this shit was going to bite you in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
Manuel Andry, along with 85 slave owners, had come back across the river on the other side.
Yeah.
So basically what that means is that the army of enslaved people were now sandwiched between the militia on one side and this slave owner army on the other side. And they didn't know that the slave owner army was
exactly
there.
Exactly. So that was something that, I mean, in my head, I think they really thought that Andry was dead. I would assume that they wouldn't leave unless they thought he was gone, because otherwise there would be some sort of knowledge of some sort of threat that could happen, because this was a surprise. This was, you know, 85, did you say? Men, I have 80 written, so I don't know. Men that were coming from the other direction. So when they were moving the other way, they were still slowly being moved inward upon.
Right. And it was still, so this entire time also, to just throw another wrench into the plot, it was raining. So there was this torrential downpour that was happening during this
whole time. Of course it was raining. So, and if you were writing a Hollywood script for this, you know that even if it wasn't raining, whoever the scriptwriter was raining would make it raining, because
that's right.
It makes for a great battle scene. It really does.
Ups the stakes.
Yes.
Ups the
There's
stakes.
There's mud everywhere, blood everywhere.
But it really did cause an issue for them, because they were taken off guard. So they're planning their attack on this militia. So they're moving backwards, planning on like, okay, when we get to a point where we can have the advantage, we're going to attack them.
Yeah.
And if that had happened, I really do think they would have stood a pretty strong
chance. They would have definitely stood a chance against, mm-hmm, I mean, 500 versus, let's say, maybe a little over 100.
Mm-hmm.
And both sides have weapons. You know, I would say that the odds were in their favor.
Absolutely. The odds were absolutely in their favor. But unfortunately, they were surprised by this group of 85. And they don't know exactly what happened next. But there's a lot of speculation that because of the rain and because these people were unexpected that they happened upon, it obscured their vision. And what we do know is that the army of the enslaved people ran out of ammunition fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. And because of this, the slave owners began slaughtering as many black people as they could. And soon the militiamen had caught up on the other side and did the same. So it was just, mayhem.
I had read that within a half an hour, 40 to 45 rebels were killed and the remainder escaped into the woods and swamps. But of course, because there were so many other, you know, white slave owners and militia members out there, a lot of them were found and captured and brought back to be interrogated, tortured, mm-hmm, and then executed.
Yeah, so of that 500, you know, only a handful were taken prisoner that first day.
Uh-huh.
Cook and Kamana being part of that number. DeLon was nowhere to be found, so they spent 2 days combing the nearby swamps with bloodhounds until they found him and captured him. And when they did find him, rather than being interrogated, it's almost like these militiamen, or, you know, these slave owners who had formed this militia, they basically told Andre, like, he killed your son, you can do whatever you want to him. So he cut off DeLon's arms, shot him, and then threw him into a fire. Yeah. And that was the end of Charles DeLand. But Cook and Kamana and 20 others were put on trial, and Cook proudly admitted to killing... What's his face?
Trepanier or whatever.
Trepanier. He proudly admitted to killing him, and others did also proudly admit to their part in the uprising as well. I mean, like they said, it was like freedom or death.
Exactly. Well, and with freedom or death, this is the part that really hurt me, was that a lot of the captured enslaved people were sent back to their slavers, which honestly, I would rather be put to trial and death at that point after everything that they've been through. And their whole slogan being freedom or death, being brought right back to your slavers,
right,
is so sad.
Here's the thing, even though I feel like maybe I misspoke earlier when I said that these people found them to be disposable. They did, in one respect, like we said, the death rate was very high in exchange for sugar. But it's capitalism, right? Yeah. So everything has to be weighed. The reason why their lives were disposable is because the benefit to the amount of sugar that they were bringing in was more important to them at that time.
Right.
But the reason why... not all of them were executed on site, although a good number of them were killed by firing squad. But the reason why a handful of them were returned to their slavers is because
they still had work to do.
It's money.
Yeah.
Like they're,
well,
it'd be
you
like throwing away money.
Yeah, you can't,
they're their workforce.
You can't lose all of your, you know, what would be like employees, I guess, in a perfect world. So they had to still have their workers there, and to ensure that their sugarcane company would continue to run, you know. So,
and I can only imagine, probably, and this is just speculation, right? And so we have no way of knowing this, but I imagine that a lot of them probably would rather have died than be subjected not only to go back to the conditions that they were working under, but also whatever punishment that surely was doled out.
Yeah, it was definitely brutal. These executions were not civil executions whatsoever. A lot of times these people were tortured. Their bodies were cut up. A lot of times they were decapitated. Yes. There were over 100 heads that were placed on pikes down the German coast after this happened. Like, it's such gross Game of Thrones fear-mongering tactics that were so rampant during the time.
When you say like 100 heads on spikes, I really want to put it in perspective, because like I said earlier, the French Quarter was about 40 to 60 miles from the Woodland Plantation.
Uh-huh.
These 100 beheaded heads that were put on spikes were along the river from the Woodland Plantation to the French Quarter. So you're talking 40 to 60 miles.
Yes.
Of, imagine that. Like, imagine driving 40 or 60 miles and it's heads along the river. And this was Claiborne, the governor. It was him and the planters who decided that that's what they would do to dissuade future uprisings. It's hard because, you know, Claiborne has a street named after him, a major street in Louisiana. A lot of these slave owners who owned a lot of these plantations, that a lot of these plantations are named after that we've mentioned today, they have cities and towns named after
and
them
this
in
is,
Louisiana.
And this is probably a big reason for why Claiborne even began to be somebody of stature in the population, because he wasn't seen, it doesn't seem like he was seen as a very popular governor of the territory before this happened, but it seems like he really took this as a political opportunity to change his perception by the people. You know, he was suddenly portraying himself as a strong governor and leader who, you know, led a successful attack against a rebellion. You know, I think that he used this story in the beginning of kind of, you know, his origins of becoming a political leader as a way of kind of upping his status.
Right. And I do want to point that out, because I feel like so often when we're talking about the founding fathers, right, I understand that things are nuanced and there are shades of gray, and in everything. Like, I understand that. But we oftentimes look at these founding fathers as, we never want to say anything bad about them. Anytime someone brings up that they owned slaves, very often people will just push it aside and say, well, you know, they were a product of their time or whatever.
Or look at all the good things they did.
And I think it's important to really highlight, like, what these people did. I mean, Claiborne said, put human heads on pikes so that we can continue to use people as free labor for our gain. Because also the next year, Louisiana gained statehood the next year, and it New Orleans became the largest slave market in the United States. Mm-hmm. That's who you're dealing with here. And I understand, like, Claiborne isn't a, quote, founding father the same way we think of Jefferson or Washington or any of these other people. But he did kind of act in that same way. And it was
on a smaller scale. Yeah, it was Thomas Jefferson who put him there. It was James Madison that, that you know, backed him up. It was Lafayette, you know, all the members of Hamilton's cast. Well, not the cast, not the people in the cast. Never mind. But all
Hamilton didn't own slaves, so we can give him that.
Did you see, though, that there were records that came out recently that are saying otherwise? Yeah,
I did not.
Yeah, I'm gonna look for it because I saw it when I was nannying, and T and I, you know, bond over Hamilton. That's like our thing. And so I read that, and I like interrupted his schoolwork, and I was like, Theo, I have to read this to you.
I'm gonna need to read that because I thought that he did advocate for abolition.
He did, but there was something. I believe it wasn't that he necessarily owned people himself. It sounds like he was in the business of helping other people procure enslaved people, from what I can remember. I read this back in like the spring, so I'll Google it when we get off this recording and try to find that article. But yeah, there was some sort of paperwork that was implying that he had something to do with slavery.
Well, that's anyway, a topic for another
anyway,
time.
Yeah. So, but what I was going to say about Claiborne, you know, we think of these founding fathers as being like, you know, just like we talk about government now, like the biggest figures, like who was the president, who was in charge of all of these really major things. But just like now, you know, it's the local governments, it's the small governments that we're building, you know, especially at this time when we weren't united yet. These are, you know, colonies in different areas that were territories. So I think Claiborne, in a lot of ways, you know, he swayed so much power in that area. And because of that, that's why we have the slave history that we do in New Orleans and things like that, because we had leaders like him that were in charge of these areas.
Right. I mean, if this had gone differently, imagine how different the landscape would have been. I mean, I think my family was already in the United States at that point. Most of my family was already in the United States at that point. But my family were slaves in the New Orleans area.
Yeah.
Like, if this hadn't happened, if we hadn't had the largest slave market in the United States that was bringing people over from Africa, how different would our country have looked? How different would it have been maybe this revolt had been successful? How different would things have been?
Would this have inspired other rebellions? I mean, there were so many other rebellions, but would this have inspired more successful ones? Would this have spurred the end of slavery quicker? I don't know. You know, I know. And it really, the most upsetting part about this story is that they really were set up for nothing but success. Like, everything, you know, now knowing the full story and not just the side of the victors, knowing the strength and the knowledge that they had on their side, it's so upsetting that the story had to end with their defeat and the wiping out of a very large Black population in New Orleans.
Right. Yeah, it absolutely did. And it did have after effects. You know, we were talking about, I actually think it would be really interesting to do an entire episode on like the noir codes and things that happened in New Orleans, specifically around Creole people.
Yeah.
And in relation to Black people, because it's a very, very interesting culture. But it did change the way that even free Black people were seen, mm-hmm, in New Orleans proper, right? Like, it changed everything. This revolt changed the relations between even freed black people in the city and white people.
Yeah, the racial tensions, I'm sure, were magnified by, you know, 1,000% after that, you know, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. there was more distrust, more fear between the two communities, where I can see that, you know, being a freed black man or woman in the area would not be easy after something like this occurred.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So despite the fact that, you know, despite the size of the rebellion, it was not covered in history books, of course.
Yeah.
And tales were largely passed down orally through generations of black and Creole people in Louisiana. So it was kind of an oral tradition. They were saying even into the 1920s, people were talking about how their grandparents had been involved in this in
That's
some
so
way
cool.
or lived on plantations. Yeah, where this had happened. The Whitney Plantation in St. John the Baptist Parish opened in 2014, which is one of my ultimate goals, to go to the Whitney Plantation mm-hmm. because, unlike a lot of other plantations that are still open for tours, a lot of other plantations are very Gone with the Wind style, focusing on the antebellum South and the lives of white
people. The slaveholders. Yeah.
Right. And occasionally, you know, they might take you into one of the cabins where the enslaved people lived.
That would be
but in general,
devastating to witness.
Right. Right. In general, they're mostly talking about the lives of white people. But the Whitney Plantation is owned by black people. They bought it, I believe. And they're the first plantation museum in the country that is dedicated to the slave experience exclusively.
Wow.
And the Whitney Plantation has a memorial and information to commemorate the 1811 slave uprising. I believe they even have, which is very disturbing to see, but I believe it's there that they have the statues. They have an entire like statue structure of heads on pikes. And since 1995, the African American History Alliance of Louisiana has led an annual commemoration at Norco in January every year.
Is that the reenactment?
No, not quite.
Okay, because okay, so, I was watching videos of the reenactment.
Me too.
Okay.
I watched that video as well. So that is different, but the 1995 one does have descendants of members of the revolt, typically, will come.
So cool. We need to take field trips when this is over. Like, I think you and I need to find places like this and then go and then record episodes about what we saw.
100%. I still have family in the
we
area.
We need to
family
do this.
In Franklin.
I would
we can go
love
for sure.
to go here and experience that.
Me
that
too.
Sounds amazing.
We should go to the Whitney Plantation.
Let's do
I've
it.
Always wanted to. So when this is over and we can travel again, 100% would love to go on a trip. I say
road trip.
Let's do it. Yeah. Or maybe we can, because it's very far.
True. It'd probably be cheaper just to get like a Southwest ticket and fly.
But in 2015, artist Dred Scott, who that is not his name, he changed it because I was like, wow, that's interesting. He was going to grow up to be
an artist,
you know, activist with a name like Dred Scott.
Yeah.
But he did change it to be Dred Scott after that case. And he began organizing a massive reenactment of the uprising. It is a 26-mile walk, 2-day event.
Mm-hmm.
And it took place in November of 2019. And it is
wild.
I wish I'd known about
it.
Because I was like, man, I would have tried to go like that.
It looks incredible. It looks like the energy of a protest on steroids.
Well, they put $1 million into it because it is a full reenactment in that they managed to get 500 people from across the country
mm-hmm.
who wanted to participate. I think they'd planned it for like a year or two because they got authentic costumes.
Yeah.
Like everyone is in costume. They have drummers. They have, you know, reenactment swords and axes and
Wait,
guns.
Wait, say that word again.
Swords?
Do you say swords?
Swords?
Okay, you said swords this time. I swear the first two times you said swords.
I may have.
Okay.
I don't
Sorry,
know.
It's like when people say possible. It's like when people say hanger instead of hanger. It drives me crazy. Sorry.
Hmm.
I don't know, didn't mean to disrupt your flow there.
No, I'll know when I listen back. Okay. you're probably right.
Yes. So they had all of the legit, you know, costumes, yes, and the and weaponry.
They do all of the actual reenactments, yeah, as well. So they have someone playing Andrew.
I was just going to say, like, that guy who plays Andrew, the guy that plays Trepanier, the guy. Oh, crazy. Mm-hmm. That would be, I would, like, as much as, like, it's so easy to, like, mock and judge these, like, reenactments, because they are, kind of, like, especially when you watch, like, Civil War reenactments or things like that. Like, it just looks like a bunch of grown-ups weirdly playing make-believe, but there is something so fun, like, especially, like, the actor in me that would, like, love to participate in something like that. Like, put me in the costume, have someone pretend to bash me with an axe. Like, I'm right, all in for that shit.
Yeah, and the difference to me is that this is, like, a story that has been so buried by, yeah, history, and there's still so much, like, I almost cried, actually, watching it, because there's so much pain there, yeah, still from, you know, all of these people, descendants of slaves, still have all of this generational trauma that has to be worked through. And well, so, and to watch,
I was gonna say, that's why to me I almost got the energy of, like, a protest on steroids, of that, like, that feel, the emotion, the emotional energy coming off of everybody gave me that same kind of, like, intense feeling, yeah, you know.
Yeah, and I like how he ended it, you know, he didn't, he's like, everybody knows that slavery was cruel, and everybody knows that the things that were done to enslaved people was cruel, and we don't need to end our 2-day journey with this reenactment with what happened afterwards, with,
yeah,
with the brutality. So instead of, you know, really highlighting the trials and the heads on spikes and, like, all of the things that happened afterwards, yeah, he hosted a giant celebration where they had African dancing and they had drums, and they just really celebrated the fact that these people showed the fact that they had strength and agency, that they desired for something different and better, because in the South, there really is this revisionist history of the happy slave.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, and it's important to note that, like, these people were not happy,
yeah,
with their lives on the whole, and they wanted something better for themselves and their children,
yes,
and they fought for,
exactly,
that.
Exactly. And I think that having it be retold in a way of, in the way of reenactment, is really powerful, because this story isn't very well known. So being able to watch that video, because I was just reading about it, there aren't any full length documentaries about it. There isn't a real way to get, like, a full picture when you're reading all these different articles and you're piecing it together. So watching that and kind of see, I'm feeling like I was watching it go down, it really helped me understand and put the whole story into perspective and place and tie together and understand what really happened. Because, you know, there are a few books and different authors that I read about their research and how that's the reason why we have a lot of this information. But when people aren't picking up these historical texts and books, the best way to teach people about something is through art, through media, whether it be through a movie or a TV show, mm-hmm, or a reenactment.
Absolutely.
Where people can actually see it and witness it and experience it. That's why we hold on to those stories, because we have that sort of, like, memory of it happening. You know what I mean? Especially for the stories that don't have any sort of, like, real written history, to be able to see it in some way helped have everything come together for me. And it was such a,
yeah,
beautiful, beautiful video. I'm sure being there was absolutely moving and unreal.
Yes.
So beautiful.
I think so. I mean, I love that area. I'm serious, Madigan. I would love to go there with,
yeah,
you. Like,
Max wants to take me to New Orleans
because
he loves the food. So he wants to take me there for all, like, the food stuff. But
Louisiana is a wild place, but it's unlike any other place in our country. But it is so, there's so much history,
yeah,
there, and it's so fascinating.
I've never been anywhere in the South.
Okay. Well, Louisiana's, I mean, New Orleans in particular is different from other parts,
yeah,
of the,
yeah,
South, but, it's very cool. I still have family there, and, I just did, just a side note for our listeners, I just sent in my 23andMe, so I'm waiting to get my
results back. Please, you have to tell us your results when you get them.
Oh, 100%. I 100% will. I think I'll probably make a video and release my results, because, you know, that's part of it is when you we're going to end this episode, but because it's the first week of Black History Month, and I feel like I try to highlight this every year because I think that it's something that people don't think about enough, mm-hmm. is that part of the trauma and part of the heartbreak of the Black experience in the United States is not knowing where you come from. And, like, really not having an understanding. People don't get it because they're just like, I don't understand why you can say you're proud to be Black or you're Black power or any of these other things when I can't say that for being white. And it's because I don't know where my family came from in Africa.
Yeah.
I can't say I'm proud to be Nigerian or I'm proud to be Ugandan or Cameroonian.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, I can't say that because I don't know. So all you are is Black because you've had everything stripped away from your culture. So I'm very excited to get my 23andMe back. Mm-hmm. I want to see, like, kind of like where in Africa did my dad's family come from?
Oh gosh,
That's exciting.
Yeah,
it's
something that I feel like people definitely, and when I say people, I mean white people, myself included, take for granted, because I had an archives account and I was able to go back and see, you know, some of my family history back to almost the 1600s. You know, it's pretty crazy mm-hmm. how I can just go online and find the names of these people. And I can say, you know, I'm proud to be Irish. I'm proud to be, you know, part Czechoslovakian. I'm a little French, you know, all of these things where it wouldn't make sense for me to say I'm proud to be white. You know what I mean? It's like there's these right. different nationalities that I can tie myself to. And that's why it doesn't work both ways. You know, it just sounds, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, yeah, obviously, I mean, it doesn't work both ways for other reasons as
because
well. But
I understand, like, for my mom, for example, like, our family, same. I was able to trace back the white side all the way back to the 1600s. So as far as my mom is concerned, she doesn't consider herself English or Welsh or anything else. She considers herself white American. You know what I mean? And from that perspective, I understand when people say, like, why can't I say I'm proud to be white? Well, you can say you're proud to be American because at that point, that's what you are. Your family has been here for so long. I get that.
White people have a very different stake in this country than any other group of people. So stating any sort of pride doesn't make any sense because you're already at the top of the totem pole. You know, you don't need to rub it in anybody else's face. We need to be lifting other people up, right?
Right. You can be proud of who you are, but your skin color in particular doesn't have anything to do with it. Black people are the only ones who get to say that because we have no idea.
Yeah.
It's why I always capitalize Black when I'm talking about Black. People ask me why I do that.
I think.
And it's because if you were talking about somebody who was American or Norwegian or anything else, you would capitalize that because it's their nationality. I mean, not their nationality. It's their ethnicity.
Yeah, yeah.
For Black people, Black is our ethnicity.
Definitely.
Like, that is what it is.
Yeah,
you know?
I remember reading an article about that when all the protests were happening over the summer. I started noticing it happening in different articles. I changed it on my phone so that it's automatically capitalized and, you know, different things like that. Because I think it is important to have that be an active part of change in our culture to, like, even something as simple as capitalizing the B in the word Black and acknowledging the fact that there is a whole separate, identity that's different than, you know, the white experience, you know?
It is a different ethnic group.
Yes, yeah.
I think that's the thing that people don't understand is it's not arrogance or, you know, misplaced pride or whatever you might
think.
No,
it just makes sense.
That's stupid. it just makes sense because, like, we can't say anything else. What do you want me to say?
Yeah.
Like, my ethnicity is, you know, Black.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. No,
you
I
know,
think
African American and American. Like, that's it.
I think that's always really important to to bring up. So thank you for doing that. And I'm so excited to hear about your 23andMe results.
Thank you.
Gonna be fun. I can't wait till I can do that one day. I mean, I pretty much know what's gonna happen, but like, I would love to see all the ins and outs. I want to know all the medical stuff too. Like, that's really fascinating
to me.
Might send me into a panic and making a doctor's appointment immediately, but we'll see. All right, everybody. Well, before I get into the usual spiel, I wanted to mention again that we are wanting to set up a Patreon and get some merch out to you all. So we would really love to hear your responses about different things that you would like to hear from us on the Patreon. And also, what kind of merch you'd be into? What do you want to see? Are you into it at all? These are things that we are working on right now. So any sort of feedback from you is so important. We love to read it. We love to hear it. So please feel free to email us at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com. You can also direct message us on Instagram at @angryneighborhoodfeminist and follow us there. We have a Twitter that we sometimes use at YAMF Podcast.
YANF
Podcast. We have a Facebook business and group page. You can go ahead and chat with the other listeners on the group page and rate and review us on the business page. And then when you're done with that, go on over to Apple Podcasts if you haven't done so already and leave us a review there. That is such an amazingly helpful way for you to support the show. So if you have not done so already, please, 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 please go over to Apple Podcasts and show your support. We will show our support right back by featuring you on our Instagram for reviews day two. Tuesday. Am I forgetting anything?
I don't think so.
All right. I think that's all. That's all we got for you today. With all of that being said, we encourage you
to rage on.
Bye.